Okay, it's September 15th, 2010. We were at the offices of Brian Cave in Washington, D.C., interviewing Mr. Jeff Krontle. Mr. Krontle, my name's Chris Seifer. I am with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, along with the other folks on this side of the table. We were established by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act of 2009 that tells us, amongst other things, to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis, including to look at various subjects, including the role of derivatives, which of course CDOs come under, and to look at every institution that failed or would have failed but for the receipt of substantial government assistance that I at least think Merrill qualifies for, since when the B of A acquisition went down, they did get some additional TARP money due to the losses that they said they discovered in 4Q08. So with that, before I ask you to summarize your educational and work background and get into the substance of the interview, I know your counsel wanted to make a statement for the record.
Yes, we object to the recording of this to the extent that it will be released publicly or otherwise made available to anyone other than the commission staff for its use in verifying information. We will be requesting confidential treatment by letter and for the record, orally now, we are requesting confidential treatment of the tape recording.
Chris, Red Brown from Wilmer Hale here on behalf of Bank of America, which owns Merrill Lynch. Gail Innes is here with me, as is Michael Hazel. Earlier today, we gave you a letter regarding confidential information belongs to Merrill that may be shared today and the terms on which we're making that information available to you.
Right, and it's my understanding that I think Gary's going to get back, Mr. Cohen's going to get back to you on that letter. My understanding. Okay, Mr. Krontle, with that, could you please summarize your educational and work background, starting with college, please?
Of course. I graduated from the University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School, with an undergraduate degree in accounting in the spring of 1977. At that time, I was enrolled in the business school as well, the Wharton MBA school, so that simultaneously with earning my undergraduate degree was my first year of business school, so I earned an MBA from the Wharton School in the spring of 1978. The summer of 1978, I started at Salomon Brothers in New York, where I worked from 1978 to 1988. I was employed as a bond trader there. I was a managing director, started in the mortgage securities department, and spent most of my career there in the mortgage securities department. I left Salomon Brothers in the summer of 1988 to go run the fixed income department and joined the executive committee of L.F. Rothschild, where I stayed for approximately 1 year, to the summer of 1989, when I joined Merrill Lynch as a managing director in charge of mortgage trading in 1989. I stayed employed at Merrill Lynch from the summer of 1989 through the summer of 2006. And I don't know if you want me to go through any more detail of my 17 years in Merrill or not?
I do, but first, my understanding is that you came back to Merrill after you left in the summer of 2006. Is that correct?
Well, I was hired as a consultant for the firm. I was not an employee of the firm. I was hired as a consultant of the firm in December 2007, and I stayed as a consultant through, I believe it was the middle of July or the end of July of 2008.
Okay, so yeah, take me through briefly your positions when you joined Merrill from 89 to 2006, and I am going to be mainly interested in the 2004, 2005, 2006 time frame. So if you can just briefly describe your positions.
Of course. When I joined the firm in the summer of 89, I was in charge of the mortgage and asset-backed trading desk. In 1995, I also took over the U.S. derivatives business. and please understand the dates of the best of my recollection.
Sure.
I think they're pretty close. In the summer of 97, sometime in 97, I was put in charge of the global liquidity businesses of Merrill Lynch, which included all sovereign trading in G7 countries, all derivative trading, interest rate derivatives in G7 countries, and the commodity business that the firm had at the time. I did that to 1999, where I got involved with some of our e-commerce type initiatives, and then in 2000 I got involved with the investment portfolio of our bank and overseeing kind of the asset liability mix of our banks, which had expanded. In the early part of 2002, the end of 2001, early 2002, that time frame, I started running a business called Global Principal Investments in Structured Finance, which, you know, included, continued to include the investment portfolio of the bank, but included a lot of our structured finance businesses, which included residential mortgages, commercial real estate asset backs, but also included principal investing in lots of different asset classes, and included our middle market lending business called ML Capital, which was based in Chicago. In the summer of 2005, my responsibilities expanded, and I oversaw our credit trading operation, which was mostly a sell-side credit trading operation, and the business name changed to CREST, which was called Credit Real Estate and Structured Products. And that was my responsibility till I left, when I left in the summer of 2006, July 2006.
Okay. And who did you report to when you were, you know, from the late 2001, 2002 time frame until you left in September of 2006, and tell me if it changed?
I reported at the start in the 2002 range directly to Dow Kim, and at one point, and this I'm not exactly sure the time frame, probably 2003-04, I also started reporting to Greg Fleming. It was Greg and Dow were co-heads of something called the GMI business, so you kind of reported to both, but I really reported to Dow. But I, at one point, took over real estate investment banking as well, which was something I reported directly to Greg Fleming on. So somewhere in that 2003-04 time frame, I reported to both gentlemen, both Greg Fleming and Dow Kim.
Okay. And that was the case until you left in the summer of 06?
Correct.
Okay. Why did you leave in the summer of 06?
I was fired.
By Mr. Kim or Mr. Fleming?
Well, I was in a room and told by Dow Kim.
Okay, and why? What did he say? What's your understanding?
Well, he was very clear that the firm felt that a reorganization was needed and that we needed a single head of our debt securities business, that they were going to put a gentleman named Osman Samirci in charge of the business, and that under the reorganization, there was no job for me.
So was there not a single head of debt securities before that time?
That is correct.
Okay. Trying to understand any discussion on why you were not considered or made the single head of the debt securities division?
No.
Did it come as a surprise?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ask for any further clarification, understanding on why you were being let go?
Yes, I did.
And what were you told?
That Dow felt that we needed to reorganize the business, and he felt Osman was the best person to run it.
Do I take it then that you didn't get any further clarification?
That's
since
right.
That was the same?
Yes.
Okay. And before we get into the substance of what you were doing while you were there, explain to me the circumstances of coming back and when you came back as a consultant in December of 07, I think you said.
Can you define that question a little more when you say circumstances?
Sure. Who first contacted you to come back as a consultant in December of 07?
I don't remember who first contacted me. It was either Greg Fleming or Peter Kelly. But I'm not sure which one, since I did have conversations with both of them.
Okay, and regardless of which one it was, what did they say?
Would I consider coming back to the firm as, they felt like they had a lot of exposure to a lot of securities that they felt I understood. And the firm, in their view, didn't have necessarily the right level of expertise at the moment and could use some more help with thinking through what to do with the positions they had.
Okay. Now, of course, in December of 07, we know from doing our research that Mr. O'Neill had retired from the firm in late October after the October 24th 3Q07 earnings release and the first reporting anyway of some fairly large losses in the ABS CDO portfolio and on the subprime portfolio. When you mentioned earlier that they told you that they had some exposures, what kind of exposures were they talking about that they wanted your expertise to help with?
I don't specifically recall, the exact conversation, but it was in and around CDOs and residential mortgage securities and other securities that had been under me when I had been at the firm.
Okay, and obviously you agreed to come back, and although you were a consultant, what were your job responsibilities when you came back in December of 07?
It wasn't totally clearly laid out, it was, again, conceptually it was getting involved in assessing, the exposures and what to do, whether to dispose of, and the potential for disposition of assets in and around CDOs specifically, but also residential mortgage securities, commercial real estate loans and securities, among other things.
Okay. I will tell you, just from looking at the company's quarterly earnings releases, starting with the January 17th, 2008 release and for fiscal 07 and fourth quarter 07, and then going through, the company reported both net exposures and net write-downs on various asset classes, including the ABS CDOs, the subprime real estate, and then other exposures within, I think they called it like in the U.S. bank, whether it was subprime, Alt-A, commercial real estate, et cetera. Were those the types of asset classes that you were working on to, assessing exposures and seeing whether or not they could be disposed of?
Yes, among other things.
Okay, and what were the other things?
I got involved, for example, with the sale of Merrill Lynch Capital to GE Credit. The firm had made a decision to sell ML Capital. I believe it was December of 07. It could have been slightly earlier to GE. There were issues in and around the sale and the structure of the sale that, since that was a business I had run, they asked me to get involved with, so I got started getting involved with the people involved with that sale. I started getting involved in discussions with potential equity people who the firm had approached to potentially put in equity into the firm. I got involved with discussions with rating agencies in and around Merrill Lynch's ratings. And then I also spent time just working with some of the individuals involved in lots of different businesses just because it was just the firm was somewhat dysfunctional and in crisis, I would say.
Mm-hmm. What specifically were you doing in terms of assessing exposures when you came back to these various asset classes?
Well, first of all, since I had been out of the markets for a year and a quarter, I was trying to get a better understanding of what the markets were, and they were very illiquid at the time. I was working, trying to get a handle on specifically understanding where all the exposures were and the extent of the exposures. I was working with lots of different individuals. I mean, at this point, it's 2.5 years ago.
Right.
I can't recall everybody I talked to, but I spent a lot of time working with whether it was the finance people or the trading desks or the risk management people, just trying to get an assessment of exactly what was owned and what the markets were doing with the securities.
Mm-hmm. So I know from looking at the quarterly earnings releases throughout 2008, after you came in, that Merrill was recording various write-downs on the asset classes I mentioned earlier, and also setting up credit valuation allowances on a lot of the hedges they had with the monolines. Were you involved at all in either the valuations of those assets that led to the write-downs or the analyses that led to what I'll term the CVAs on the hedges?
Again, as a consultant, I had no role in valuation. Certainly at times I was asked an opinion on an assumption or two, but I really had no role in the evaluation process.
Do you know who was performing the valuations of the assets on which the company was reporting write-downs on throughout 2008?
I don't know who specifically made the decisions in and around valuation allowances. I don't know specifically who made decisions around marks.
Do you know who was participating in that exercise, regardless of who was making the final decision?
To the best of my recollection, it was David Sabatka, who was in charge of the, I don't know what they called it at the time, I think it was fixed income and commodities or some FIC or something like that. They had changed the name. Certainly Nelson Chai, who was a CFO at the time, was involved.
Let's go back then to the time before you leave the firm in the summer of 2006. Now again, we've seen in the documents that we've looked at, and some of the folks that we've talked to, and in a lot of the public documents, that Merrill ratchets up, my phrase, the ABS CDO part of the business, and goes, becomes the number one CDO issuer, I think, in 2004, 2005, 2006, and maybe even 2007, I forget. But can you just generally describe what your role was in that business in the 2004 to until the summer of 2006 timeframe?
Certainly. The CDO business really has a couple different components. There was an ABS CDO business where the underlying collateral was mostly ABS products, which included subprime securities and other type of residential securities, along with other types of asset-backed securities that were being used as underlying collateral. There was a small CMBS, commercial real estate CDO business, that was in existence on Wall Street at the time. There was also a CLO business, where the underlying collateral usually was corporate loans. And there was a smaller business that used other types of collateral, like trust securities from banks and other things, kind of same conceptual framework as the corporate loan, but using just different types of collateral. So at the time, a lot of the structuring expertise was the same, even if the collateral was, understanding the collateral was different. So in 2004, To the best of my recollection, the business was run overseen by a gentleman named Mac Taylor. Bless your time.
I'm sorry. The last name came Mac, right as the sneeze.
Okay, Taylor. Mac, Macaulay Taylor. We called him Mac Taylor.
You paid him to do that.
And Mac must have been.
That's what I mean.
Yes, okay. And Mac oversaw the CDO business. I don't remember who ran it specifically under him. He oversaw many different kind of derivative, credit derivative type businesses. Mac reported both to Jeff Chandler, who was running credit trading, and therefore oversaw the CLO and corporate loan type structuring. And he reported to myself for overseeing kind of the asset-backed and commercial real estate type reporting. During that time frame, the business was growing pretty dramatically around Wall Street, and we were doing okay, but I think marginally well at best in terms of our market share and market penetration. Mac approached us and talked about potentially bringing someone on board to to bring our abilities in that business to another level. I don't know whether I assume Jeff Chandler met with him, but I did meet with Chris Ricciardi. I believe it was either in 03 or 04, some of that time frame. Mac had spent a lot of time meeting with Chris. I met with Chris. The firm made a decision to hire Chris during that time frame, and then Chris came in and ran the business till working for Mac, who continued to report to me through the summer of 05. In the summer of 05, as I described earlier, we changed the organizational structure and we started Credit Real Estate and Structured Product, better known as CRESP, at which point Mac Taylor reported to Jeff Chandler, who then reported to me.
So just to make sure I heard that all right and have my notes right, before it was Mr. Ricciardi reporting to Mr. Taylor, who reported to you, and then in the summer of 05
to me and to Jeff Chandler. Okay. Mac Taylor reported through the summer of 05 to both Jeff Chandler and myself.
Okay, and then in the summer of 05 he's just reporting to Mr. Chandler.
Correct.
Okay, and understanding that's the reporting relationship, what are your job responsibilities, involvement in the CDO business?
I, at the time, ran a very global and very large business starting in the summer of 05 during that time frame, I had something like 3,000 or 3,500 people reporting to me, multiple business lines, of which the CDO business was, one of many. And represented a small part of our revenue and profits at the time. So I probably spent the equivalent amount of time, in and around that business as it represented. And maybe even slightly less, because a lot of my focus was on some of the overseas businesses that we were expanding more rapidly than some of the U.S. businesses.
Okay. You mentioned that the CDO business represented a small part of the firm's revenues and profits at that time. What time were you talking about, and did it change?
Well, it's certainly the profitability of that business grew pretty dramatically, as did the market itself and our market share within it. But even when I left the firm, it was probably under 10% of my revenues or at most 10% of the revenues of the businesses I ran. You know, I ran probably, I'm not even sure what percent of the revenues of the firm at the time, but within even debt, that probably meant it was, 2 or 3% of the revenue of debt, or 5 or whatever. And obviously smaller as you go up the firm.
Okay, but is it accurate? I'm just trying to get a general understanding of the amount of the business it comprised, and understanding it was less than or equal to 10% in the summer of 06 when you leave. Was obviously less than that before Mr. Ricciardi came on the scene in 2003. Did it get up to 10% in 04, or help me understand just the general ramp?
You know, honestly, a lot of my businesses were growing pretty dramatically. Mm-hmm. At the time, it wasn't just the CDO business, or a lot of the other businesses I ran were ramping up. So I think it probably was never much different than 5 to 10% of the profitability of the businesses I ran.
Okay.
Even though it grew with the rest of the businesses.
So what kind of reports were generated, if any, written reports were generated, if any, on the CDO business?
When you say written reports?
Internal management reports that would, for example, tell you, here's how many we've issued, here's who's buying them, here's the revenues, here's the profits of the business. I don't know what kind of reports there are, so that's why I'm asking.
Okay. We certainly had reports that listed our positions in CDOs that would come out on a daily basis.
And let me stop you for a minute. When you say your positions in CDOs, do you mean retained positions by the firm?
Correct. Okay. And they obviously, that was the broad, our being Merrill Lynch's positions. We certainly had profit and loss statements that came out on a daily basis relative to those positions. So we had risk reports and profit statements that came out. We got updates in terms of, any deal mandates, usually when those mandates were received. That's when you ask for reports, those were the ones that at this point I recall.
Okay, and how periodic were those reports? Monthly, quarterly?
I don't recall. They certainly were at least monthly.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think it was any worse than monthly. When it came to the reports about mandates, our P&L reports and risk reports were daily.
Okay. When you mentioned the risk reports, is that the reports on the retained positions?
Yes.
Okay. And how for the guy that's never worked on the street, explain to me what the P&L reports looked like and how you would measure the profitability of the CDO business.
I think P&L reports would be different for different layers of management. So are you talking about P&L reports I may have received?
Yes, the P&L reports you received or know of.
A P&L report, that I would receive, because those would be things that I know. I would get a P&L report for all my businesses on a daily basis. It would be based on the marks from the people in charge of those positions, because they mark positions on a daily basis. And it would list the businesses by, at a high level, would list the individual businesses that reported to me. At this point, 4 years and change ago, I don't recall the exact level of detail, beyond that.
In addition to the revenues and expenses generated by the marks on the retained positions, I take it another source of revenue on the CDO business, simply the fees from selling them, right?
Correct.
Okay, and then what were the other type of expenses? I mean, did you have a cost accounting system where the salaries of the folks working within that division was allocated in?
That would generally not show up on a daily basis. if I recall. I mean, that was more of a monthly expense report that would hit your monthly P&L.
Okay. So other than potential revenues or profits that derive from the marks and from the fee income, were there other sources of revenue or profits within the CDO business?
Carry income. So any security you carried, you financed, and you either earned a profit or a loss based on the carry on the position.
Okay. Now, you mentioned these risk reports on the retained positions. Was Merrill retaining positions from the beginning of starting this CDO business, or was the business, or was the goal anyway of the business to sell everything that was being packaged and then sold?
Well, the main goal of most of the businesses of Wall Street is to sell the positions. And certainly the goal of the CDO business was to, structure and sell positions.
So now I'll tell you, but before we get there, I mean, we've seen reports that certainly show when you get into late 06, after you're gone, of course, and then into early and mid 07, the retained positions, at least the net retained positions, rise fairly dramatically. But I want to get an understanding from you of what the level of retained positions were before you left in the summer of 06 and whether it changed. Do you have any recollection of that?
I don't have a total recollection of the CDO business itself, what the level of retained positions were. Remember, your positions on a daily basis are changing every day. You're selling some, you're doing new deals. But I don't recall, within the realm of the businesses I ran, I don't recall the retained positions of CDOs being, a large part of the positions, and the balance sheet that I ran at the time.
Did Merrill Lynch, during your time there, ever purposely retain positions in the CDOs that it was underwriting and issuing?
Well, what I would say is when you underwrite and syndicate a deal, right, you can't always sell every position before you actually bring the deal to market. You would try to pre-market deals, but as with any deal, whether it's corporate bonds or even equities or whatever, you don't always sell every security before you price the deal.
Right.
So sometimes you did make a decision to retain a piece of that when you priced the deal, and then you would potentially try to sell it. You might try to sell it the next day. You might decide that the market was not going to be good for that security today, but might be good in a week, and then try to sell it in a week. You make a decision that the price I could sell at today is not a good price, and you could hold it for a week. You could decide to hold it for a month. Mm-hmm. But, it wasn't the significant majority of those positions were trying to consistently be sold.
Okay. Now, at any time before you left, again, we see Merrill Lynch as the number one issuer, I think also including it in 2006. Was there ever any discussion or anybody voicing the viewpoint that the company needed to reduce its exposure, whether on the warehouse side or on the retained position side of the CDO business?
We did have discussions at times as the business grew, and as the business grows and as your market share grows, generally your warehouse grows. So the warehouse was, I can't recall the exact size, but it was certainly a reasonable size to in the market. So we had discussions among the people involved in the CDO business. During that time frame, I can recall discussions with Dow Kim and the management team as to, should we have bigger and smaller risk positions across a lot of different asset classes at the time. So yes, it was, that was one of many things that we had discussions about during that time frame of 06 while I was still at the firm.
Okay. What was your feeling on the matter? Let's stick with the first half of 06, since right that is right. You leave in summer of 06.
Yeah, I left in July of 06. We had multiple discussions because credit spreads and spreads of all credit type products, whether they were corporate bonds or commercial real estate loans or anything, had come into relatively tight levels, historically tight levels, to treasuries. And so we had lots of discussions, you know, within the management team as to whether that would continue or whether spreads were a risk. To the best of my recollection, I was, you know, nervous generally about parts of those positions, and therefore, had many discussions about them. But I don't think we specifically ever made a decision to lower the risk dramatically at that point in time before I left.
Is it accurate to say that your general nervousness about the CDO positions also extended to the non-CDO positions that were real estate related?
Generally is a always a tough word. What I would say is that there were always are certain things that I felt were probably overvalued in the marketplace, and there were certain things around the world that I probably thought still made sense to own, in the marketplace. Generally, I was more nervous than not in the spring and summer of 06.
Were you recommending that the company reduce its exposure to these types of asset classes?
Not that I recall.
I believe I've actually read, and I don't have the article here or articles, but I think it's been reported in the financial press that did have something to do with you leaving in the summer of 06, with disagreement with Mr. Kim and perhaps others on the level of exposures, and specifically the real estate exposures within the firm. Is that the case?
I don't believe so.
Okay. How did Merrill go about choosing collateral managers for CDOs?
I was not involved in the choosing of collateral managers, so I don't recall at this point, you know, how exactly that was done.
Do you have a general understanding of how the collateral was chosen for the CDOs that Merrill was issuing?
Yes.
And what's your understanding?
That the manager who was overseeing the CDO would suggest to us securities that they would like to buy and potentially put in their CDOs. To the best of my recollection, we had an ability to overrule that decision if we did not like the collateral, since the warehouse lines were on the books of Merrill Lynch. So generally it was a process where the portfolio manager would make a suggestion as to a bond, we would approve it, and then it would go on the books of Merrill Lynch and then be sold at sold into the deal at the time of pricing of the deal.
Do you know whether or not Merrill required the collateral managers to choose securities that was in Merrill's inventory to be part of the CDOs?
To the best of my knowledge, it did not.
Okay, I take it you've seen the various reports in the financial press, whether it's ProPublica or otherwise, where it was saying, particularly in the 2006-2007 time frame, and I understand you're only there for part of that time frame, that as the market started to not be as liquid as it used to be, that in fact was happening, that Merrill was telling collateral managers, look, you've got to choose our stuff to help us clear out our inventory and put it in the CDOs. Any knowledge of anything like that going on, at least at first, when you're there?
I have no knowledge of that.
And then same question once you leave?
No, I have no knowledge.
And when you came back in December of 07, did you ever hear anything like that or see any documentation within the firm that was going on?
Not that I recall.
Did you ever have any discussions with anybody at Merrill Lynch, at either as when you were an employee of the firm or a consultant of the firm, about that type of alleged practice?
Not that I recall.
There's been allegations in a suit against the company by a bank called Rabobank that Merrill was using proceeds of long investors' purchases of CDOs to then buy securities from Merrill. Do you know whether or not that was the case? Do you understand my question?
No.
I saw the look on your face, and I could tell that. Let me try again. There's an allegation in the Rabobank suit that the long investors in Merrill CDOs, folks that would pay cash for a tranche, whatever tranche it may be, that cash was then used by that CDO to purchase securities from Merrill Lynch. Do you know whether or not that is in fact the case in any deal, not just that deal?
I don't know.
Okay. What's your understanding of why Mr. Ricciardi left the company in February of 2006?
He was offered a very, from what he told me, he was offered a very, very good job by a client of the firm that he was close to, and he thought it was a good opportunity, and took it.
That was Cohen and Company, I believe?
Yes.
And was Cohen and Company, before Mr. Ricciardi went there, also a collateral manager that Merrill used for its CDO deals?
To the best of my recollection, yes. Okay.
You mentioned earlier you didn't have any involvement in choosing collateral managers. Did you have any dealings with the collateral managers after they were chosen?
Certainly some of them.
And just generally, what was the nature of your involvement with the collateral managers?
Well, some of the collateral managers were entities like PIMCO, Trust Company of the West, and were very large clients of the firm in multiple areas, many of which I oversaw. So, you know, I would have a more senior management discussion with them about the relationship of the firm, of which the CDO business was just one of many aspects of it. Mm-hmm. So generally it was with the bigger managers in the firms that, you know, had broad relationships with the firm. So I had some historic senior management relationships with, for example, the senior management of PIMCO. So, you know, I would have conversations with them over time.
Did the nature of the business between Merrill and Cohen and Company change at all after Mr. Ricciardi went there?
I don't know.
I believe in September of 06, Merrill, and granted this was after you left, but Merrill acquired, I believe, First Franklin, which was a loan originator. any involvement in looking at that acquisition before it occurred, before you left the company?
I had no involvement in looking at First Franklin, and to the best of my recollection, there had been no discussions with First Franklin's owner, who I'm blanking on at the moment, while I was still at the firm.
So you don't recall that being a possible option before you left?
I didn't say that.
That's why I asked.
Yes. We had been looking at mortgage originators for a reasonable period of time, and certainly First Franklin would have been in the list of potential acquisitions, you know, well before the decision to buy it, probably 2 or 3 years earlier. And to the best of my recollection, at that time, it was not available for sale.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned earlier about your general nervousness in the 6 months or 7 months before you left in July of 06. Understanding that in that time frame, too, the company was looking at the possibility of acquiring loan originators. Do you recall any discussions internally about this isn't something we want to do, given what's going on in the market?
Well, we did have discussions about, you know, whether or not, you know, buying the loan originator would or would not make sense, you know, multiple times.
And understanding you recalled general discussions about whether or not it would make sense to acquire a loan originator, do you recall anything more specific, you know, in terms of was there a camp that was saying, look, we shouldn't do this, another camp that was saying, yes, we should, and then the decision was made to do it, or was it just, did a consensus get reached?
No, I think there was, you know, kind of different people on different sides of that discussion, I think. Generally, Mr. Fleming was a little nervous about buying, you know, a mortgage originator. Generally, Dow Kim was a little more in favor of buying a mortgage originator. Those were kind of two, you know, they were my two bosses, so
right,
they would be the natural people to have that discussion with. But I would say generally.
Right. How, the extent you, what's your understanding of how Merrill went about marketing its CDOs that it was issuing in the 2005-2006 time frame?
I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Okay, how did it find buyers?
We worked through the sales force, which is how we sold, you know, the majority of securities at Merrill Lynch.
Mm-hmm.
We had a syndicate desk that was involved, you know, that, you know, would work with the issuer and with the people who covered the issuers. We would then talk to the sales force. We also had a couple people who were kind of adjuncts of the sales force, whose job it was to have a lot of expertise and to help the sales force explain the securities to accounts. And so it was a pretty normal syndicate process.
There's been reports that you've probably seen by ProPublica and others that, you know, some of the folks that were taking long positions like Magnetar were taking long positions in the equity tranches and shorting a larger part of the deal. Were you involved in any of those transactions, Magnetar or otherwise, where an investor was taking both a long and short position in a CDO deal?
Not that I recall.
Do you recall hearing any discussions about any of those deals?
No, I don't recall.
Did you have any interaction or involvement with the rating agencies in terms of getting the deals rated?
No.
Were there any limits in terms of concentrations, and particularly concentrations as a percentage of capital, on the type of exposures that Merrill could take in any type of asset class?
At this point, I don't recall limits as a percent of capital as being something that, you know, was kind of the driver of the limit system at Merrill Lynch.
Do you remember limits, other types of limits?
Yes.
And what were those?
Generally, the limits were put in place by the assessment of the risk of the positions and the risk could be based on rating, it could be based on the volatility of the security, it could be based on, you know, the assessed risk of capital loss or gain.
Again, for the non-Wall Street guy, is that similar to the whole value at risk type of analysis?
Yes, it would be.
Who was Merrill's chief risk officer in the 2006 time frame, anyway, before you leave, do you recall?
If I recall, Keishi Hatsuki was the head of risk just before I left. But he reported to the best of my recollection, Ed Moriarty, who was the head of risk and credit. So I guess there were, depending on whether you want the head of risk or the head of risk and credit, there were two people who were, you know, Keishi, who was specifically on risk, and then Ed, who oversaw both risk and credit.
And can you just describe the risk management function at Merrill generally? I mean, was there a separate risk management department? Were there also risk managers within business lines? Can you help me understand that?
There was a separate risk management function at Merrill that reported in through the CFO side of the organization, the non-business side of the organization. Historically, there was no separate risk group within the business, though that did change at some point before I left.
And how did that change? And when, if you recall?
What I would say is that John Bright had been the head of risk at the firm. He had at one point, I believe, thought of retirement, and at the time, Dow Kim had asked him to come over and work more directly with Dow and his senior people, thinking about risk from the business side's perspective. So, John Bright, I'm guessing that occurred in 05, somewhere in there. I don't think it occurred a month before I left, and I don't think it occurred 3 years before that, so, you know, somewhere.
Right, and just so I'm clear, you had mentioned, I think when you left, the chief risk officer was Keishi Hatsuki?
To the best of my recollection, yes.
But was John Bright the CRO before Mr. Hatsuki?
Yes.
Okay.
Chris, we've been at it for about an hour. Are you
close to being done, or do you take a break?
Well, let's take a break.
Okay.
Break.
Okay, Mr. Crossell, I've handed you a document that's titled Presentation to Merrill Lynch & Company Board of Directors, Leverage Finance and Mortgage / CDO Review, dated October 21, 2007. For the record, it's got Bates stamp numbers BAC-ML-CDO 77035 through 77085. But as I told you before we turned on the tape, I'm only interested in asking you about a couple of pages. So
right. I think this is a document that you're not suggesting that he would have seen, nor in a board meeting that you used for you.
Are you asking me a question?
I'm asking.
I'm not suggesting anything, but I'm going to ask him questions about the document, including whether he saw it at any time. I understand that he left in July of 06 and came back in December of 07,
okay.
So that it's certainly probably the case that he didn't see it on October 21st, 2007. but to get that out of the way, Mr. Crontel, do you know whether or not you've ever seen this document?
I don't recall ever seeing this document.
Okay. Thank you. Directing your attention to page 061 on the Bates Range PowerPoint deck, slide number 23, titled ABS / CDO Inventory Chronology. Do you have that page in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so the first third of that, looking at those five bullets, the second bullet indicates that what the aggregate positions at the end of August 2006 were in terms of the CDOs and the warehouse. I understand you left in July. But generally, do you recall whether or not that's consistent with your recollection about what the retained positions were in the July 06 timeframe when you left?
I don't recall.
Okay. Now, the next bullet says that Mr. Ricciardi exited, says he just exited, and there was a strong desire to retain the number one position. I'll tell you that it's my understanding he left in February of 06. Do you recall when he left whether or not there was a strong desire to retain the number one position at Merrill Lynch?
I think there was strong desire is always a word that's hard to define. There was a desire to retain a number one position. Yes, there was a desire.
Okay. Now the next bullet talks about ongoing discussions regarding the purchase of the subprime mortgage originator. Earlier today, we were talking about you were having discussions in 2006 about the possibility of buying loan originators. So is that bullet consistent with your recollection of the first 6-7 months of 2006 when you were still at Merrill?
Well, there certainly were discussions regarding ongoing purchases of a mortgage originator. I'm not sure I understand who FIC management was at the time.
That's what I was going to ask you next, the next part of the bullet. And as you noticed, it says FIC management bullish on growth, bullish on asset class. Understanding you're not sure who FIC management is referring to, before you left in July of 06, is that an accurate statement that Merrill, let's make even more general than FIC, was Merrill still bullish on growth and bullish on the asset class, and I'm assuming that means the subprime asset class?
I would not say Merrill Lynch overall was tremendously bullish on the growth of the subprime mortgage business.
Okay. Now the next bullet talks about Citi taking a more aggressive view on senior tranche pricing and AIG retreating as a significant purchaser of senior tranches, and that both of those developments made pricing unattractive, and then it goes on to say there were changing certain dynamics of the CDO business. Does that jog any memory bells about either of those types of, either the things mentioned in that last bullet before you left in July of 06?
Yes, it jogs my memory slightly.
Okay, and what do you recall?
Well, to the best of my recollection, AIG had actually left maybe the end of 05, early 06. It was, I don't think they were buying them by the spring or summer of 06. And I do vaguely recall discussions that Citicorp or Citigroup might have been keeping some of the senior tranches for themselves at the time.
Okay. Now, and just so I'm clear, since I have looked at AIG during my time at the FCIC, when it says AIG retreats as a significant purchaser of senior tranches, was AIG actually making cash purchases of senior tranches or writing CDS on them, or both?
To the best of my recollection, it was writing CDS.
Okay. And then it goes on in this bullet to say both developments made pricing unattractive. What does that mean, if you know?
I don't know.
Okay. 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 Now, frankly, the rest of these bullets, I believe, cover a time period after you left the company in July of 06. But I still want to ask you about them, and in the context of, did you hear anything about this after you left or when you came back in December of 07? So, after you left or when you came back in December of 07, as indicated in this second set of bullets, did you hear that Merrill continued to ramp up the CDO inventory and warehouse through the end of 2006? Do you know anything about that?
Through the end of 2006.
Because this second set of bullets is labeled late summer to year end 06. So,
I don't recall conversations at the, you know, late summer, late fall, winter of 06 at all relative to the CDO business at Merrill.
Okay. And then going to that second to last bullet where it says, in order to execute deals, ML continues to take down senior tranches into inventory. Did you ever hear after you left in July of 06 or when you came back in December of 07 that Merrill was taking down senior tranches into inventory to execute deals?
Yes, I certainly was aware, you know, by then that Merrill had taken down positions in the senior tranches.
And was that the case before you left?
Well, as I said, whenever you do a deal, sometimes you position securities, but to the best of my recollection, the purpose at that time on senior tranches was really more of an interim position in order to take time to sell them, but not with a thought process to hold them for a longer term.
Right, and that's actually what I'm getting at. Do you know whether that there was sort of a change that you just mentioned there, where at some point in time, other than, look, we may need some time to sell this stuff, but we don't want to hold it, there wasn't actually a change in Merrill's, like, we're going to actually hold this stuff?
I'm not aware, nor was I involved in any discussions about, you know, any decision to change the thought process of how to run the CDO business.
Okay. Okay, and then going into this January to February 07 set of bullets on this first page, these bullets indicate that there was, you know, deterioration in the subprime market, but that it was confined to the subprime and not leaking into the CDO market. Again, my same kind of questions. After you left in July of 06 or when you came back in December of 07, do you recall having any discussions where that similar to what this bullet is saying? Is that there was a belief at Merrill in this time frame, in the January-February 2007 time frame, that the deterioration of the subprime market was confined?
Not that I recall.
Okay. Going to the next page, in the March to May 2007 set of bullets, it's talking about an active risk mitigation strategy being undertaken and an attempt to reduce the warehouse by printing deals. Again, my same question, either after you left in July of 06 or when you came back in December of 07, did you ever have any discussions with anyone about whether or not this was about this supposed active risk mitigation strategy?
You know,
And let me tell you, for whatever it's worth, during the October 24th, 2007 conference call, When Merrill announced its 3Q07 results, Mr. O'Neill actually did say during that conference call that Merrill was trying to reduce warehouse risk by getting the warehouse into deals and constructing CDOs and issuing them, if that jogs a memory bell at all.
Well, I was aware that Merrill did print deals and end up keeping some of the senior tranches. Obviously, when I went back to consult, there was the evidence of that.
Right.
And I was also aware from being aware of some of the exposures to some of the monolines that the firm had actively worked during some of these time frames on, to get some of the positions monoline insurance.
Now, then in these indented check bullets, the first one says, over time, ML required to take certain mezzanine tranches to execute deals. Did you ever hear anything about that?
Not that I recall.
Okay. And again, the next one says that over time, certain mezz pieces needed to be enhanced contractually in order to be made more attractive for sale, and that was done to the detriment of senior tranches. Again, same question. You ever hear anything about that?
Not that I recall.
Okay, going down to the bullet that says market during this period, and then there's three checks underneath them. And it says both the first couple of checks say that there appears in the March to May 2007 time frame that there was still a market to sell senior positions and mezz positions, but then the parenthetical says, albeit at a loss. Again, when you came back, did you learn that in this time frame, or any time frame, frankly, that Merrill could sell senior and mezz positions, but could only do so at a loss?
I don't recall conversations along those lines.
Okay. Okay, and then the next bullet talks about the expectation that spreads had blown out temporarily and that they would come back, and that the 1998 experience, presumably the long-term capital management experience, reinforced that view and that liquidity was still present. Do you recall any discussions about that?
No, I don't.
Okay. And I take it you don't necessarily know why Mr. Kim left in May.
No, I don't.
Okay, going to the next page then. You'll see in this market risk chronology slide, it talks about how the director of market risk, Mr. Lee, I think it's Ming Lee, noted the growth in the CDO inventory and discussed the issue with his management and the business line, and then according to the slide was made comfortable that the business was aware of the risk, that it wasn't material since it was AAA, and that the company's stress scenarios indicated that the position was not a material risk, but that business risk management failed to note the growth of the CDO inventory, and that the market risk management continued to focus on the DV01 metric, which was an insufficient metric to evaluate the true nature of the risk, and that as a result, the growth of the position and the aggregate exposure was not highlighted to senior management. Again, when you came back, or after you left in July of 06, or after you came back in December of 07, did you ever learn anything along these lines that the risk management function didn't know about the increasing retained position of ABS CDOs, or that senior management didn't know about the increase in the positions?
Well, I'm somewhat confused in that as I read this.
Okay.
Market risk management was aware.
Right.
Okay.
And all I'm getting at is, after those three checks, it says the business risk management, which, tell me if you're interpreting this differently, I'm taking it different than market risk management, did not note the growth of the CDO inventory.
Okay. So...
What's a question? I'm sorry.
So my general question is, when you come back, after you leave in July of 06, and when you come back, do you recall having any discussions with anyone about whether or not senior management or business risk management knew or didn't know about the increase in the retained ABS CDO positions?
I do recall a couple conversations related to, but I don't really recall with whom, that the metric that was used, DV01, okay, and some of the other metrics used, which kind of were a, you know, VAR type analysis, since many of these securities didn't historically have a lot of volatility, that it, I wouldn't say hid the exposure, but made the exposure not seem so large.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, for example, when you were contacted by whoever it was that led to you coming back as a consultant in December of 07, at that time or afterwards, did you ever have any conversation with anyone or did anybody ever tell you, look, we found out we had this large exposure in ABS CDO positions that we didn't know about until late 2007, October 2007 or later?
Well, I don't think they would have, anyone said, I didn't know about, okay? There was this sense of we didn't recognize how risky it was.
Okay. When you came back in December of 07, did you ever have any discussions with Mr. Thain?
Yes.
Okay. Did you have discussions with him before you returned as a consultant?
If I did, it was, you know, maybe a day before I came back or something. I mean, it was, you know, right around his arrival, and he obviously was focused on a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. But they were not significant discussions.
Okay, and that's what you anticipated my next question. Other than that initial conversation when he comes in as CEO, did you ever have any discussions with him about the ABS CDO positions? What I'm getting at is that he communicated any concerns to you that stand out in your memory.
I had many discussions with John, and many discussions with John and larger groups of people, of which the overall positions of the firm were discussed.
And what do you recall, if anything, you know, specifically about, you know, the retained ABS CDO positions?
Most of the discussions related to, you know, what did I think of our ability to sell the positions.
Did he ever talk to you about the risk management function at Merrill as it related to these retained positions?
Not that I recall.
Okay. Did you participate at all in the earnings calls after you returned as a consultant?
I was present at the January
17th,
whatever date it was, yes, 17th, I'll take you for your word there, that it was the 17th of 08, it would have been, right. Of 08 call. I was in the room during the time of the call.
Okay, and the reason I'm asking you these questions before that about Mr. Thain is during that call, and maybe you'll recall this, in his prepared remarks, or at least before the analysts start asking questions, he said that, you know, it was very important that we emphasize to the organization going forward the importance of risk management. And he went on to say, in the leverage finance area, he did a very good job. But he says, on the trading side, in particular as it relates to CDOs, we did not do a good job. And that really begins at the first line of defense, which are the trading desks themselves. And then he went on to say, trading businesses don't make money if they don't take risks, but the risks that they take will be sized appropriately to the businesses. None of the trading businesses should be taking risks, either single positions or single trades that wipe out the entire year's earnings of their own business. And they, of course, certainly shouldn't be taking risks to wipe out the earnings of the entire firm. We will be reducing the type of carry trades that are very balance sheet intensive. Does that jog any memory bells about any discussions you had with Mr. Thain or, frankly, anybody else within the company when you returned about their concerns or feelings on the ABS CDO positions? Those are fairly strong comments in my mind.
That doesn't jog my memory.
Okay. Now, he also went on to say during that conference call that Merrill had reinstituted a risk committee. Did Merrill used to have a risk committee when you were there, and did it disband it?
I don't recall a risk committee. It did have, well, no, let me take that back. It did have something called the ROC. Now, risk, I believe it was Risk Oversight Committee that the firm did have in place while I was there.
And it was in place when you left in July of 06?
To best of my recollection, yes.
And who were members of that committee, if you recall?
I do not recall all the members of the committee. I was not on the committee.
Was it a committee of the board?
No, it was not a committee of the board.
Management committee.
It was senior management of Merrill Lynch.
And understanding it existed when you left in July of 06, again, when you came back, did you learn that it no longer existed and was being reinstituted? Or I guess what I should just ask, do you know what Mr. Thane is talking about in terms of this reinstituted risk committee?
I do know that he put together and met pretty much daily with the senior management of the firm. That included senior risk management and senior trading business personnel to discuss the risks pretty much on a daily basis. So I think that's what he was calling the risk committee or risk oversight, whatever he called it, committee.
Of course, Chris, you'll be able to ask Mr. Fay his questions on Friday.
Yes, I will. And I will. And do you recall having any discussions with Mr. Thane, Mr. Chai, or is it Chai? Kai? However you pronounce it, the new CFO. Along these lines of for lack of a better phrase, you know, how did we get into this position that we're in?
I don't recall any of those any conversations along those lines.
Okay. You mentioned you attended the January 17th, 2008 call. Did you attend the others? July?
To the best of my recollection, no.
Okay. Were you involved at all in preparing the quarterly earnings releases or the conference call scripts or anything like that?
Of those calls? No. Not the best.
July of 08, you said you left, right?
I left in July.
Can you explain to us generally how the compensation system worked at Merrill Lynch in the time frame before you left, in, for example, in the 05-06 time frame?
Sure. My understanding was that the board working with, or some part of the board working with senior management at Merrill Lynch, set a range of bonus pools that then senior management allocated to different businesses, and it kind of was like a pyramid and waterfall. They would get allocated further down. Then you would then take those pools and spread them, around your businesses, and then, to the point where you would then get individual names back with suggested compensation levels, and then there would be, would go back up the line in terms of oversight and review, and then be blessed by the individual layers of management until it was brought back to the board for final approval.
What about at the beginning of the year? Were you, for example, would you have certain goals or objectives to meet that you would be evaluated against at the end of the year?
Yes, I generally had certain goals, some of which were financially related, so some of them, in other words, might have been management related, of which I believe had an impact on compensation of me personally and other members of the firm.
And were those written? I mean, would there be something written in the beginning of the year that says, here's, go forth and meet these goals, and we'll look at it at the end of the year?
Generally, we did write down, we would have budgets. you know, financial budgets by business. So that was effectively your goal.
Right.
And then we would list other goals that to the best of my recollection, we would write down.
Okay. And were the financial goals, anyway, were they based on, were they annual for the year?
Usually they were annual for the year, yes.
Do you know whether or not there are any clawback provisions in any of the compensation at Merrill Lynch?
Meaning,
if you get paid X million dollars of a bonus or stock this year, some of it can be clawed back next year or the following year if certain conditions occur.
I am personally not aware of any things that you would define that you just defined as clawback provisions.
And then at the end of the year, would there be any kind of written document that you would receive saying, here's your evaluation and here's the basis of your salary increase, bonus, stock award, whatever else was part of your comp?
My evaluation was usually verbal, mostly verbal, though there was usually some written evaluation as well. But it would be usually a little more detail on the verbal side. And I would usually receive that at a different time than I would hear about or give compensation.
Okay. And who did you receive your verbal evaluation from?
Dow Kim.
Okay. And that was...
I'm assuming you're talking about...
0506.
Thank you.
Nice. Okay. And then you said there would be a less detailed written document. What explain to me that document?
It would usually just talk about your performance for the year, both in terms of financial goals as well as, you know, your view of my boss's view of my leadership abilities, you know, and other, you know, aspects of my job that they thought were important.
Was that like a standard form that was filled out for all senior managers, or was it just email, for example, that Mr. Kim would prepare and send to you?
No, it was a standardized type form.
Okay. And that you would get each, well, certainly you got a written document like that in 05 and 06.
The best in my recollection, yes. Okay. No, not in 06.
Well, of course, right. I'm sorry.
05.
Shot range?
We're close. Good. When I was looking at the company's earnings disclosures for 4Q07 through the end of 08. I believe before that time, Merrill didn't disclose its gross exposures for the ABS CDOs. It would disclose the net exposures. I think I know, but can you explain to me what the difference is between the gross and net exposures of Merrill's ABS CDOs?
I'm not sure I would understand without seeing how they portrayed the longs and shorts, what they mean by that.
Okay. One of the things I've at least seen in some of the quarterly earnings releases is one of the differences between the gross and net positions were the hedges they had on with the monolines and other financial guarantors. Is it your understanding that that is at least one reason for a difference between gross and net exposures for ABS CDOs?
I don't know.
Okay. Now, I thought you mentioned earlier that when you came back as a consultant, you did work with the financial guarantor. Is my recollection incorrect?
Yes, I spent a little time on that. That's correct.
Okay. Can you just describe what you did in that little time?
I didn't spend a lot of time on it. I did spend some time looking at the exposures, you know, and to the extent of, you know, with exposures with some of the monolines, just any thoughts about, you know, were there ways to restructure and unwind some of the monoline exposures and did it make sense to approach some of the monolines to unwind some of the exposures or not.
Okay. And I will tell you, and this maybe this will jog some memory bells, in the first and second quarters of 2008, probably in the fourth quarter of 07 too, Merrill One, you know, was disclosing that it was recording credit valuation allowances on the hedges, particularly to the monolines that were in trouble. And then two, shortly after the July 17th, 2008 earnings call, I think like 11 days later, they disclosed a $30.6 billion CDO sale to Lone Star Funds. And in addition to that, there was terminations and settlements of various hedges with the monolines. Were you involved either in the sale of the ABS CDOs to Lone Star or the unwinding slash termination slash settlements, how they were termed in the earnings releases anyway, of the hedges with the monolines?
Yes.
Okay. Can you explain to me what your involvement was?
From a time frame perspective, this is the best of my recollection. I believe in February of 08, I received a call from Lone Star. I don't remember if it was John Graykin or Len Allen talking about, asking about, would Merrill have interest in selling some of their structured finance positions, specifically CDOs among others, to Lone Star. Which I proceeded to bring the senior management to ask if they had a desire to have those discussions. I had known Mr. Graykin for a long time, and I knew Len Allen from probably discussions I had had with him a year earlier. So I brought that to senior management of the firm, and we entered into some sorts of discussions with Lone Star at that time, February or March of 07 to 08, to the best of my recollection, that was the time frame.
Okay. So, I mean, I know, on July 28th, the firm issues a press release saying we've done this deal, so I take it there was involvement beyond this February 08 time frame.
Yes, I proceeded to, put together, was given, I don't remember who, whether it was Mr. Thane or Mr. Sabatka or someone else assigned a small group of people headed to the best of my recollection by Donald Quinton to work with me on potentially selling positions to Lone Star. We entered discussions. We spent from February or March through April or May going through individual positions with Lone Star. Having discussions with them about so they could get a better understanding of the size of the positions, the attributes of the individual positions, we then at which point I believe it was April. They gave some indication of a price they might be willing to pay for a reasonable amount of positions, at which point I brought that to myself and Donald Quinton, brought that to senior management, and at that time there was a decision made that we would not sell the positions at those prices or even enter any further discussions with Lone Star at that time.
Okay.
Then my understanding is, even though, and I like to explain, kind of my consulting arrangement, I was on site at Merrill Lynch in the World Financial Headquarters through June 1st.
Okay.
Right. And then I was up at my company, which we had started earlier in the year, and worked from my company's offices, and I was handing off. I spent the next 4 to 6 weeks really handing off all the stuff that was going on. So it was more of a very high level, a couple hours a week, to, I think it was 5 to 10 hours a week of time that I was spending kind of handing stuff off but you know, but my real active role ended June 1st. So, you know, I no longer was involved really in the interface at, from June 1st on, between Lone Star and Merrill Lynch.
Understanding that, did you know or understand, you know, what the deal was that was announced in July? And what I'm getting at is you had mentioned that I think in April you weren't willing to sell at whatever they were willing to buy.
Well, Merrill Lynch wasn't willing
at that time, right? Of course,
yes.
That Merrill Lynch wasn't willing to sell. At least the July 28th press release says that it's $30.6 billion being with a carrying value of $11.6 being sold for $6.7 billion. You know, however you do the math, it is what it is. But was that more than what you Merrill was unwilling to sell it for earlier, less, the same? Do you know?
The best of my recollection, we never really ever, Merrill Lynch never really had a decision as to what it was or wasn't willing to sell it for, only that it was unwilling to sell it for anywhere near the indication the Lone Star had given. But I don't think Merrill ever got to a point of saying, here is a price I would be willing to sell it at, in that April time frame.
Okay, I understand that, but did Lone Star say in that, and I think you said it was April 2008 time frame, that here's what we will buy it for? They said a price that they would buy it for, right? Or indicated a price that they would buy
indicated
it for.
A price. It never got to the point where it was a firm offer from what I know.
Right, and understanding that, was that indicated price, if you know, more or less the same as the deal that was done in late July?
I don't know the exact price, and nor do I know all the collateral, whether the actual collateral was the same, so I really was not involved in the July, so I cannot compare it back to any indication of April.
Okay, and then can you describe for us your involvement with the termination settlements, unwinds of the hedges with the monolines in 2008?
I was aware of some of the thought process that was going into and was involved in one or two meetings relative to the thought process of how to think about what, you know, what the value of the unwinds would be. But to the best of my recollection, I was never part of a discussion with any or final decision on any unwinds with any of the monolines.
Okay, so were you negotiating with any of the monolines?
No.
Okay. Okay, I misunderstood. No more dealings with, strike that, no more consulting work for Merrill after July 2008, is that accurate?
That is correct.
Clauses of the financial crisis?
I'm getting there.
There we go.
But first, causes of Merrill. So, and I'm sure probably both your counsel prepared you for this question, or at least told you it was coming. As you're at Merrill a long time, as you look back, you know, what do you see as the mistakes were made, lessons learned that led to the problems that Merrill had?
Obviously, it's a very complex question with no clear answers. I believe there were. You know, there were many causes of the problems at many of the firms. Merrill itself, to my opinion, probably had not enough senior risk takers at the firm who had experienced as risk takers. Ultimately, had a risk management function that, from a reporting perspective, was too far away from the CEO and senior management of the firm.
Let me ask you about that, because I thought you said earlier that the chief risk officer reported directly to the CFO?
The chief risk officer did report to the CFO. That's correct.
So help me understand then why your statement that the risk managers were too far away from senior management. Did I misunderstand you?
Well, meaning the CEO.
Okay. So by senior management, you mean the CEO?
Yes.
Okay. Have you ever had any discussions with Mr. O'Neill since he left in October of 07 about Merrill?
No, I have not.
Have you had any discussions with anyone within Merrill about what you were just talking about you know, the not having enough risk managers and the risk managers that were there being too far away from senior management?
I want to make sure that my statements were understood.
Okay, please.
not having enough risk managers. My view on that was the firm, in the end, did not have enough seasoned risk-taking business professionals with a lot of experience, and so risk managers could be a word of risk management. What I was defining was, in my view, the firm didn't have enough seasoned business side professionals who were trained in trading and risk management. So can you repeat the question now that I've redefined?
Oh, actually, let me, I'll do even better. I'll ask you a different question that's hopefully clear. Did you ever have any discussions with anyone at Merrill before you left in July of 06? Strike that. Did you believe before you left in July of 06 that Merrill did not have enough seasoned risk-taking business professionals trained in risk management?
I thought we had a reasonable number at the time before I left.
So what changed your mind?
What changed my mind was, you know, I was not the only one who left in the summer in July of 06. There were quite a few other very senior business professionals who left in and around the same time, made some on the same day, and many others in and around the same time frame, many who were very experienced professionals.
And who were they?
Harry Langsfield, Jeff Chandler, Mac Taylor, Tom Salak, Doug DeMartin.
Sorry, Doug.
Doug DeMartin. Even though Doug at the time was the head of sales, he still had experience on the risk management side of the firm. Yeah, on the trading risk side of the firm. But those were many of the senior professionals in the debt division who, in my view, had significant experience as risk takers.
And Chris is promising that he's not going to call them as a result of you mentioning their names today, so as not to ruin your friendships.
Okay.
Nothing better than a call from the FCIC.
And if Reg is going to tell them where it came from.
That's right. We'll see how strong the friendships are, right?
Or close. Uh-huh.
I'll tell them Reg told me. So I didn't know that actually until you just told me that there were others that left around the same time you did. So is that all Mr. Kim's decision too? Or are these folks working for other senior managers that make these decisions?
All those people either reported to me or reported to Mr. Kim.
Okay, so I appreciate that, but it didn't answer my question. Did Mr. Kim make the decision to get rid of all those people? Or did some of those people leave because you left?
I don't know. Well, first of all, there's an assumption there that Mr. Kim made the decision. He certainly told me.
Right.
And I reported to him. So, you know, he's the one who told me.
Right.
My understanding is he also told Mr. Langsfeld and Mr. DeMartin on the same day that they were no longer needed at Merrill Lynch. The rest of the people, to the best of my knowledge, may have been told shortly thereafter by Mr. Samurchi, but I don't know.
Did you ever have any discussions with Mr. O'Neill around the time that you were informed by Mr. Kim that your services were no longer needed?
No.
Do you know if any of your colleagues did?
Not that I'm aware.
Did Mr. Kim or anyone else ever tell you that Mr. O'Neill was on board with the decision?
He made no mention of that.
And then again, going back to the second point you made about mistakes made, lesson learned. Before you left in July of 06, did you believe that the risk management function was too far away from the CEO of the company?
I personally believe that.
And did you ever tell anybody that before you left in July of 06?
I don't recall.
Did you ever tell Mr. O'Neill?
Not that I recall.
Tell Mr. Kim?
I don't recall.
You ever tell the Chief Risk Officer?
Not that I can recall.
Before you left in July of 06, do you recall having any discussions about your feelings that the risk management function was too far removed from Mr. O'Neill?
Can you say that again?
Sure. Let me try it a different way. Anybody ever tell you they felt the same way before
yes.
you left in July of 06?
Yes.
And who was that?
Before you left?
Right.
Good.
John Bright.
Wasn't he the Chief Risk Officer?
Up until... yes, at some point, either in 05 or 06, he left that job to go work for Mr. Kim on the business side.
And was replaced by Mr. Hatsuki, right?
To the best of my recollection, he was replaced by Mr. Hatsuki.
So when did Mr. Bright tell you that he felt he was too removed from Mr. O'Neill? Or actually, what did Mr. Bright tell you?
That he felt that the risk management function was too far removed in the organization from senior management.
And again, when he said senior management, did you understand that to mean Mr. O'Neill?
That was my recollection of what that comment meant.
Because Mr. Bright reported, I guess, to Mr. Edwards at that point, right?
No.
Wasn't Mr. Edwards the CFO at that point?
Yes.
Okay. I thought you told me before the Chief Risk Officer reported to the CFO.
Well, again...
Help me.
Okay. At the best of my recollection, Mr. Bright, at the time he changed jobs, reported to a gentleman named Kevin Cox, who then was in charge of risk and credit, who reported to, I believe, Mr. Edwards, who was the CFO, who reported to Mr. Fakahani, who was the executive VP, who reported to Mr. O'Neill.
Okay. And when did Mr. Bright tell you this, do you recall?
No.
05, 06?
Best recollection, yes.
Anyone besides Mr. Bright share your feelings that the risk management function was too far removed from the CEO?
Can you tell him that they should?
Yes. Yes. or if you know otherwise.
I don't. At this point, I don't recall.
Okay. Did Mr. Bright ever tell you that he voiced those concerns to Mr. O'Neill?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if he did or didn't. And I don't
I
don't recall him telling me that he did.
Thank you. Were you a member of the executive committee when you were, before you left in July of 06?
No, I was not.
Okay. Were you a member of any management committees?
Yes.
What committees were you members of?
The operating committee of the firm.
Okay. Who were members of the operating committee?
Well, the executive committee were members of the operating committee, to the best of my recollection. And then I would define it as the next layer of management of the firm. So there were approximately 25 members of the operating committee.
And how many members were on the executive committee?
Something like six.
Okay. Was Mr. O'Neill a member of the executive and operating committees then?
Yes, he was.
So you don't recall any discussions at the operating committee about people's feelings that perhaps the risk management function was too far removed from him?
I don't recall any discussions, though.
And do you recall just discussions generally about either the risk management function being too far removed from Mr. O'Neill? You've answered it. Much broader question, not limited to Merrill Lynch. Again, everybody that's had a fair amount of time on the street were asking this question. But what are your thoughts on primary causes of the financial crisis?
I think there were multiple factors that were involved in the ultimate crisis that our countries faced. And one of which was starting with a very easy policy from the Federal Reserve. Second was leveraging of positions by the structure used by Wall Street firms. And another problem was the regulatory oversight of the firms, especially as it related to risk-based capital that was relying on ratings. Fourth was the rating agencies who certainly, in the end, missed some key aspects of the way that their ratings process looked at risk. Another problem was the level of fraud that was being committed. Supposed fraud that was being committed in the mortgage origination process. And I mean, those were, and some of the, as well as some of the guidelines given to the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac specifically, related to what their mandate was to be and some of the effects that had on the way the marketplace operated in the mortgage origination space.
And I'm not sure I understand that last one.
Freddie and Fannie were given guidelines as to the number of mortgages they needed to either guarantee or hold. related to affordable housing. That actually, you know, in the end, probably led to a mispricing of credit risk in that sector of the market.
Did you guys see at Merrill a lot of fraud in the mortgage origination process?
You know, what I would say is that, you know, we were steps removed from the origination, you know, from the actual origination process. Since when I was there, we did not own an originator. But there certainly was an understanding that, you know, some of it did occur, you know, in mortgage origination, and had for a long time. The extent of it, I think, that in the long run was misunderstood.
Did Merrill do any kind of, you know, due diligence on the loans that it was acquiring and putting in the warehouse for the CDOs that it was issuing?
We were buying, you know, rated securities, not loans.
Okay. I think you guys owned a company called Own It. Does that sound familiar?
We did not. I do know the company. We did not own the company called Own It.
Okay. So you had some kind of relationship with Own It, then, I take it. But weren't you buying loans from Own It? Or were you buying rated securities from Own It?
We were buying loans from Own It.
Okay.
And we may have bought rated securities too, but I do know we also bought loans.
So, did you do due diligence on those? And I take it they were regulated.
This is not his job. This is not his job. And
if he doesn't,
we're
know,
going on
know.
For a long time, and so I just want to wrap this up if we could. That's,
well, I think originally we were scheduled for much more time. So let me finish, and we'll hit, it'll go faster if you don't interrupt. So back to my question. I take it the loans you were buying from Own It were residential mortgage loans. Yes.
Yes.
Okay. And did Merrill, if you know, perform any due diligence on those loans?
To the best of my knowledge, we did do due diligence.
And do you know what types of due diligence that was done, and probably easier for you, do you know who at Merrill would have been doing that due diligence?
We had teams in our, you know, residential mortgage business that was in charge of doing due diligence. I don't recall at this point, you know, the people involved.
Was that under, I mean, Earl, in the very beginning today, we talked about where you were within the structure of Merrill. Was the Own It loan origination process within your business function, or was it somewhere else in the organizational structure of the company?
It was within my business function.
Okay. And just to close it out, do you recall seeing, you know, much instances of mortgage origination fraud within, from loans purchased from that company?
Not that I was aware of.
Okay. Mr. Krontel, I don't have any more questions for you. Thank you very much for your time today.
Of course. Thank you.
Good man.